Hello, everybody. Welcome back to this very nice lecture hall out of the sun. Today, or now, we are going to talk about this very important topic of cybercrime. And we have a very good expert here. He's a criminal defense attorney and is specialized in cybercrime. So he promised to answer a lot of questions about cybercrime. Give it up for Nout van Gemert.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Good. So, hello, good evening. I'm Nout van Gemert, criminal defense attorney from Amsterdam. And I'm gonna try to explain something about the wonderful world of criminal law and especially cybercrime. Why am I hosting this event? Oh, wow, that's bright. First of all, I want to provide some common knowledge about computer crime because in my practice I noticed that a lot of people have questions about it and there's also some misconceptions. And furthermore, I want to raise some legal questions, societal questions about legal developments as it comes to, for example, hacking powers of the government. And also, I want to emphasize the collaboration between hackers and lawyers. And I think at the end of this talk, you would agree with me. At least I hope so. So my talk has three chapters. The first one is common misconceptions about criminal law. The second one is the war on encryption. And the third one is about cryptocurrencies and money laundering. So about the misconceptions of criminal law. We often hear law is slow and always one step behind. And I would like to ask you, who agrees with that statement? Raise your hand. And who says, no, law is pretty fast, it can adapt? Disagree with the statement. Well, there's something else. Okay. You're the only one, anyway. Wait. You also disagree with the statement, two of you. Well, in my opinion, law is quite slow. You need to go to legislative powers, you need to make the law drafted, it needs to be voted on. It can take 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years before a law is adapted. But criminal law is actually pretty adaptive. It can bend in some way. And I can show you that with an example about stealing electricity. When the Dutch criminal code was written, you could only steal goods, like stuff. And electricity, legally spoken, is not stuff, it's not goods. So then electricity came available for the average person, and there was a man who actually stole it. Well, he took electricity without permission and without paying for it. So, police arrested him, took him to court. And, of course, his defense attorney said, well, the criminal code in the Netherlands prohibits stealing stuff, but electricity is not stuff, right? So what are you going to do about it? That went all the way to the Supreme Court in the Netherlands. And the Supreme Court finally ruled, yeah, it's true, electricity is not stuff, and yeah, it's true, you can only legally steal stuff, but we're gonna bend the law in that way that electricity is now also stuff. And by that, from that moment on, stealing electricity was illegal. And it shows that you don't need long legislative procedures to adapt the law to some new techniques. A few years later, there was the same with a computer game called RuneScape. There was this guy who had a mask and an amulet. He paid a lot of effort for gathering it. And this other guy, the suspect, he broke into his account. And he took his amulet and his mask. And the guy got pretty pissed about it, and he went to the police and said, well, this guy stole my digital goods. So the guy got arrested, and it went to court. And then the court had to examine whether an amulet and a mask in a computer game RuneScape is eligible for stealing. Because it's not a good, it's not stuff, it's just ones and zeros, right? So the Supreme Court ruled, okay, now we're going to interpret stealing and stuff in a broader sense, so that everything you can dominate and that is not multipliable and that has any value, you can steal. So now, from that moment on, you can steal computer programs, as long as you're not allowed to multiply them. And there's like three basic rules of them, what the Supreme Court said. You need to dominate it, you need to control it. It has to have value, and you cannot multiply it. If it's freely multipliable, it's of course not able to steal. I will later in this talk, I will get to some more examples about it. So let's go to the second statement. If something is not forbidden, it's legal. Raise your hand if you think that's true. And raise your hand if you think that's not true. This question is binary. Well, in theory, it's actually true. Because we have, like most countries, the first article of our criminal code says something is only illegal if we say it's illegal. You can do basically everything you want unless it's written down that it is prohibited. Criminally, of course. That is the law. But then there is politics. And sometimes society thinks that something should be criminal whilst there is no law prohibiting that kind of behavior. And we have a really nice example of that in the Netherlands. It's the Dutch decoy miner. It's about grooming. And grooming means it's illegal to go on the internet, start a chat, and chat with somebody underage, and trying to get sexual intercourse. It's called grooming, and it's one of the most severe crimes you can commit in the Netherlands. So there was this guy who went online to a chat website, and he was talking to this other person, which he thought was underage. And he started negotiating, and he said, okay, let's meet, with the intent to have sexual intercourse. So the police busted down his house, and he got arrested. But then in the end, it appeared that he was not talking to a young girl, but to a pretty old police officer. It was the decoy miner. It was a police officer acting like he was a little girl, but he wasn't. So if you look at what happened technically, there's this guy, he's an adult, talking online to this other guy who's also an adult. That's factual what happened. But still, he had the intent to talk to somebody who is underage. But intent is not criminally liable, at least in most countries. So this case went also to the Supreme Court. And the defense attorney obviously said, well, basically, he talked to a police officer who's overage, so our law doesn't prohibit that. Our law prohibits speaking to this minor. But then the Supreme Court ruled, yeah, that's true, but society doesn't really like that, so we're going to convict you anyway. Well, of course, I'm overstressing it a bit. There's more legal talk about it, but that's where it comes down to. And that also works for investigative powers. Most countries have a sole book for that. And in the Netherlands, it's called the Code of Criminal Procedure. And it says, Article 1 says, the police can only do things that we're authorized them to do. So there must be a law giving them a power to investigate. Otherwise, they don't have any power. And there's this interesting case. It's about a marijuana farm. And there were police officers that said, okay, we think in this house is a marijuana farm, and we want to go inside. We want to break down the door, arrest people, and take everything with us. Now, everybody knows you need an arrest warrant for that, right? And you need a warrant for breaking into the house. So they called an assistant prosecutor who is allowed to issue those warrants. And this assistant prosecutor said, yeah, sure, I believe you. I think there's marijuana at the house too. Here's your warrant, go have fun. And the police went inside, and of course they found a marijuana farm. They arrested some people, and they went to court. But then they found out that this assistant prosecutor, and he failed his exam. And he did a retake, and he failed that as well. So legally, he was not an assistant prosecutor. And he issued a warrant. So the defense attorney said, well, if this person who is like not an assistant prosecutor issues a warrant, the warrant is invalid, so all evidence that has been found must be taken out of the court case. And the district court agreed, and they got acquitted because all the evidence that has been found due to the false warrant was excluded from the case. And then it went to the higher court. The higher court found the same. But then it went to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court ruled, this assistant prosecutor was not an assistant prosecutor because he failed his exams. And it's mandatory to pass the exams in order to be assistant prosecutor. And yeah, they went inside and gathered evidence. But the Supreme Court said, the warrant itself is valid, and if the assistant prosecutor who was not were actually an assistant prosecutor, then it was a legal warrant. And then you could say, well, even my nephew can issue warrants, and if the warrant's okay, then you just do as you please. Well, that actually happened. It happened in 2013, and me and my colleagues were pretty surprised by it, because the whole rule that you need a law before something is prohibited, and you need a law to give people authority, is being violated by that in some way. And the third one, I heard a lot when I was talking to people who are in cryptocurrencies a lot, and they say, yeah, especially with distribution of technical programs, the globalization is causing jurisdictional problems. For example, the ledger of Bitcoin, it's everywhere. How are you going to prosecute somebody? How does it work if you use a distributed DOS attack and it comes from everywhere? What happens with jurisdiction? Can you prosecute in the Netherlands even though all the data comes from other countries? What if you use a VPN or a Tor browser? So the question is, technical globalization causes jurisdictional problems, and who thinks that that's true? Raise your hand. And who thinks, well, that's not really a problem? Well, he's actually right. It's not a problem at all. It's just impractical. But legally speaking, it's not a problem. Because it doesn't matter where someone's computer or someone's program physically is located. And sometimes that's hard to explain, but jurisdiction legally works in a different manner. And I'll state the basis of jurisdiction for you now. Most countries have two or three grounds to base jurisdiction on. And one of the most common uses is the principle of territoriality. The state says, well, this is my territory. If you commit a crime here, I'm going to prosecute you. That's what basically every country does. That's normal. But then again, there's also the nationality of the suspect. For example, if you're a German and you're going to commit a crime abroad and you come back, Germany can actually say, well, you committed a crime and we don't care where you did it. If you did it in the Netherlands or Switzerland, we can prosecute you. It's only for more severe crimes, though. And there's also something like nationality of the victim. For example, if you murder a Dutch citizen in Ecuador, and the Dutch police can get a hold on you, you will be prosecuted and convicted. And there's also some interesting thing, it's called universality. It's most for like the most gravest of crimes, like war crimes and crimes against humanity. And for example, like some countries like Belgium, they think that, okay, we have universal jurisdiction over some really great crimes. We don't care who you are. We don't care where you come from. We don't care to whom you committed a crime. We think this is so bad that we're going to prosecute you anyway. It's some self-proclaimed world police power. And the interesting thing, it's complementary. It means that jurisdiction can exist beside each other. And an interesting example is if a Swiss guy in France takes a sniper and shoots a German guy in Italy. People think, okay, you can break your head over jurisdiction, but it's not really a problem because which countries have jurisdiction? All of them. And based on those principles, all of them have jurisdiction. And the whole point is, who is going to prosecute? Yeah, that's just politics. That's legally not really interesting. If you think about that airplane that was crashed by some entities in Eastern Europe, MH17, there were Dutch people in the plane. So the Netherlands can prosecute. The plane crashed in Ukraine. Ukraine can prosecute. The perpetrator might be Russian. Russia can prosecute. So there's numerous countries that can actually prosecute the destroying of the plane. And who is actually going to prosecute? That's politics. And with these questions, I hope like in a couple of minutes to show you a bit that criminal law is not, it's not a science, it's not an exact empirical science. Like physics, for example. It's some people, a lot of programmers thinking yes or no, there's always a right answer. If you're a mathematician, you're looking for an answer. Lawyers, unfortunately, but also fortunately, think more in grayscales. There's no yes or there's no no. Sometimes the same question has two answers, depending on the time. 20 years ago, the same question would have a different answer. In empirical science, that you cannot imagine that. But in law bends, law breaks, law is adapted. There's a lot of politics in it, and especially criminal law. Sometimes, if society wants something to be illegal, it just is. And although you need, like a fundamental law says, you need to write it down first in the criminal code before it's illegal. But if we really want to, and there's really a societal pressure on it, the law can be bent and you can just use an old article that just doesn't cover it really, but just break it open, bend it a bit, and then it fits. The second part I want to talk to you about is the war on encryption. It's not really a war, but I like to state it that way. And it's about what happens in the Western world and now that people say, okay, in order to be safe, we need to know everything. We need to follow, we need to listen to communication, we need to tap phone calls, we need to break into encryption. And of course, there's a lot to say about our safety. There's like a lot of stories about terrorist threats and all evil that's happening to us right now. And there are people working on day and night to protect us from any harm that we might or not know about. The problem is that in order to do so, they want to know everything. They want to look into every detail of people's lives. So we can say, yeah, it's just a little bit of your privacy, but then you can be safe. The question is, when does it stop? And I think most of you heard about zero-day exploits. That the government can leave open if they notice about a vulnerability in a device or in a program. For example, in a phone, there's a leak, and it can be, if somebody knows about that leak, it can break into your phone. What some governments do is say, well, if we find out about this leak, we're not going to stop it. We're just going to keep it secret and use it for itself. We're going to exploit it so that we can actually still hack into to phones of people, because they really do not like encryption. Even now with WhatsApp, a lot of people don't know, but they are talking now encrypted with each other on WhatsApp. And it's really hard now for the investigative authorities and intelligence agencies to follow what's been said. But if there would be a vulnerability in iPhone or in an Android phone, and the government knows about it, they want to keep it silent so they and they alone can get into your phone and listen to what you say anyway. The problem is that the people working for the government, they have good hackers, but also the black hat hackers have good hackers, and they also can find vulnerabilities. And you can see it, like a couple of weeks ago, we had a really big ransomware attack that used one of those vulnerabilities, of whom people say that it was left open by some authorities. And also, what they do about encryption, there's this company, it's called PGP Safe. What they did is they had BlackBerries, they sold it, they adapted it a bit, and they encrypted the BlackBerries. And all the communications were via their own servers, so it was impossible for the police to wire the phone calls they made. And they run a really good business. They had thousands of phones they sold, so people could actually speak in private with each other. But then on one day, there was a raid, and the police stormed inside the office of PGP Safe. They took the servers and they arrested a lot of people. And the question is, okay, I know some agencies don't like encryption, but you should know that encrypting communication is not illegal. It's just math, right? And providing an encryption service is also not illegal. And selling phones with encryption is also not illegal. So what this company did is fine, it's not prohibited. But the prosecutor stated, yeah, well, that is true, but you're facilitating criminal organizations. Sorry? Yeah, they say they did money laundering. But they also said, like, you're facilitating criminal organization. That's going to be where they're going to prosecute. Yeah. Oh, there's a guy saying they're also suspect of money laundering. Yeah, that's true. But they're also going to be prosecuted for facilitating criminal organization. The whole point is that this is a company that uses encryption, and now some of them are in jail. And I could raise questions about, is that where we want to go? If somebody allows other people to talk in private, what happens? Is that a problem? Because, yeah, of course criminals use encrypted phones, but also journalists do. Also lawyers, I have an encrypted phone to talk with some clients, because I know the government is listening to what I'm saying to my clients when I have a normal phone call. And the whole point is that we'll see in the end, because this case will come to trial, we see if you can actually convict somebody for just providing an encryption service. Because WhatsApp is also encrypted service, and also criminals use WhatsApp. So what you're going to do, are you going to arrest everybody on WhatsApp? Also Vodafone, it's a normal phone company, but there are also criminals who use Vodafone. So are you going to arrest like the CEO of Vodafone? I don't see any difference in there, but we'll see how it ends up. And well, in the Netherlands, there's even more. We have this new law, and it's already accepted, and it said that the police can soon legally hack almost everything. And they can do that in order to investigate certain crimes. And the question is, yeah, almost everything. Yes, almost everything. Because the police can hack into your computer, two computers, but the definition of computer is a device or group of mutually connected or coherent devices of which one or more automatically stores data. And so basically it's a device that's connected that stores data. I'm not sure about you, but that's pretty much every device I have in my house. Even my remote control stores data. And so the police could be able to hack my remote control. And another law that that's passed is the legalization of exploiting vulnerabilities. There was a debate, or legislative powers had a debate about it. Like, okay, should we do that? And there were some political parties that said, no, I don't think that's a good idea. One of our parties had a whole pleadings of 1 hour and say, okay, people maybe we're going too far, maybe don't leave open vulnerabilities in system. If you find out about a vulnerability, close it. That's better for everybody. So they wanted to make an amendment, but that amendment was rejected. And now the Netherlands will have in a few months legally the power to exploit vulnerabilities. There's one thing that didn't make it. That's, I don't know if you can read it, but it's the decryption warrants. What our government wanted is the power for the prosecutor to say, okay, this is your device, it has a password, open it now, and if you don't, you're going to jail just for not complying with my warrant. So I issue a warrant to decrypt any information. The problem is that there's also something like human rights. Some people tend to forget about it. And one of the most fundamental human rights is that nobody can be forced to comply with his own conviction. You cannot enforce somebody to work with the police to convict himself. So you cannot put somebody in jail because he's unwilling to unlock his phone for you. So that one didn't pass, but we never know what might happen in the future, of course. And I saw this tweet a couple of days ago from Edward Snowden. I think it was interesting to share. It's about Theresa May, and she said, I'm clear, if human rights law get in the way of tackling extremism and terrorism, we will change those laws to keep British people safe. And Edward Snowden looked at this tweet and said, okay, well, if we take all the emotional words out, she's basically saying, if human rights laws get in the way, we will change them. And the more scared we're getting, the more xenophobia is in our society, the more human rights laws suffer. Like privacy suffers a lot, but also the right to not be disturbed by the police, the right to not work with your own conviction. And in the last few years, me and my colleague, we noticed that a lot of fundamental rights are being violated because of safety. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't try to have a safer country as possible, but it's always a gap between the safety of your country and also the fundamental rights of your country, because sometimes they do not interact well. For example, privacy. So for our security, our internet becomes less safe and our privacy is being restricted. And what if I don't like that? What you do about it? Well, as I've told, you first have the executive powers. They want more investigative powers, more authority to research, to investigate. And so they ask the legislative powers, please give us more authority. And the legislative powers just did. They passed a bill. So now you can do basically, you can hack everything. You can prosecute people who are going to encrypt. But now it's up to the judicial power. And their goal is to uphold fundamental rights as well. So is there the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the European Convention on Human Rights and all kind of national laws that protect you, me, everybody here, and our privacy. And I see it as a goal of hackers and lawyers to inform those judges that are going to make the decisions now, this year, next year. There are going to be a lot of cases about cryptocurrencies, about encryption, that judges need to decide on. They need to decide, okay, we're going left or we're going right. And in order to make an informed decision, these judges need to be informed. And that's one of my tasks as a lawyer, to present a different viewing point on a case so that the judge can make a proper decision. But also for hackers, because I'm a lawyer, I don't know a lot about technical stuff, right? I specialize in cybercrime, but I'm not a programmer. I don't know a lot about how a DOS attack actually works. No lawyer knows, but a lot of people of you, they do know, but they do not know how to explain, for example, to a judge what is the consequence of his decision. And I think that judges need to understand the consequences of their decisions. Because if they're not informed, they can say, yeah, well, encryption, it sounds like a thing that only criminals use. Yeah, let's just make it illegal. It could be. Well, of course, I'm exaggerating, but if a judge is not informed about the importance, for example, of encryption, he cannot make a proper judgment. So I see it as a goal of combined of hackers and lawyers to inform judges about it. I'll go back to that later. Because the first topic I want to talk about is cryptocurrencies and money laundering. I basically two questions for you. Who of you owns some kind of cryptocurrency, like Bitcoin or Ether or Monero? That's basically everybody, yeah. Okay. So who of you are familiar with their national anti-money laundering regulations? So there's a lot of work to do. Just to have a start, extremely short, what are cryptocurrencies legally? And I'm talking about criminal law. Private law, what's governing between civilians, I don't care about for now, it's criminal law. How are they considered? And the best way to interpret it is they're like bottle caps. They're stuff, but they're exempted from VAT. So in Rotterdam, a judge decided that bitcoins are like goods. It's stuff. It's a thing. It's not money. But the European Union decided that it would be pretty bad if you need to pay VAT every transaction, because that then you take away the whole goal of Bitcoin as a trading currency. So for criminal law, you can just, like, they're little stones. They're sand, they're bottle caps. Don't know how you, what you want to say about it, but they're things, but you don't have to pay tax. They're like in some kind of twilight zone. And there is some problems with money laundering laws with that. And money laundering regulations are fairly difficult, and they differ a lot from country to country. So I'm going to talk about the Dutch framework of money laundering. And money laundering is, by our law, he who possesses, acquires, has available, transfers or converts any object whilst knowing or should know that the object in some way derives from any criminal offense, right? Let's break that down. He who possesses, acquires, has available, transfers or converts. That's basically everything. So the first part of money laundering, check. Any object. Well, the court in the Netherlands ruled that bitcoins are objects, so check. And then there's the third part. It's like, so if you possess a Bitcoin whilst knowing or should know that the object in some way derives from any criminal offense. Any criminal offense means that you do not need to know which criminal offense, as long as you know or should know that it's from something bad happened to it. But the whole problem is that, as you see with cash, all money eventually, sooner or later, will be used in some way illegal transaction. if you wait a lot, if you, the Bitcoins change from owner to owner, and eventually somebody is going to buy drugs with it. And from that moment on, it does that Bitcoin or Ether derives from a criminal offense. And the problem with cryptocurrencies is that in contrast to cash, you can actually see, you can follow the path it has taken. Everybody can look up in the blockchain what the history of transactions is. And you say, okay, but how would I know whether my coin derives from a criminal offense? Because if I look in the blockchain, I cannot see, well, oh, it was a drugs transaction. It's just a lot of numbers. Well, then you have WalletExplorer.com. And this is a tool, or the Dutch prosecutor uses it, and it makes some data analysis with an algorithm, and it shows that where the coins have been. And it knows about some public keys, and with some really interesting, but for me, not understandable algorithm, it calculates that, for example, this wallet, the coins have been on Abraxa market and on Nucleus market. I'm not sure if you can see it, it's a bit small on the LED screen, but this is a view of WalletExplorer.com. You can type in any public key, and it just shows where it has been. And sometimes it recognizes it. This coin has been on Abraxa market. So the prosecutor now, he uses Wallet Explorer to prove that the coin of my client derives from a criminal offense. You say, yeah, you can see it, Abraxa market, that's a dark market, and they almost solely sell illegal goods there. So there's actually a case I'm doing now, and the prosecutor made this statement, in short. The coins derived from a criminal offense, you can see it in WalletExplorer.com. He did something shady with it because he bought the coins with cash and they were talking encrypted and they were meeting in the street, which is, of course, fine. It's legal. You can meet in the street and you can interact and you can do what any deal you like because it's coins, it's not drugs. But the prosecutor says the owner knew or should have known such was the case, because I can see it in World Explorer that the coins derive from a criminal offense. So the buyer can also see it. So he should have known, and now he's accepting Bitcoins that derive from a criminal offense. Thus, he is a money launderer. I'm gonna raise some legal questions about that. This case is gonna be in December, and they arrested quite a few people the only thing they did is buying coins and giving cash back, and it did not investigate where the coins derived from. But then my questions for the judges are, the first one is there a duty to investigate the origin of received coins? Just because you can. With cash, you cannot. Well, it's really hard. But with Bitcoins, it's fairly easy. So if you can investigate it, is there a duty to investigate it? So, and if you fail that duty, do you take the risk of being a money launderer? And I think it's going to be really interesting to see what the judge is going to decide on this, because if they decide, yeah, there's a duty to investigate, that's going to change how people interact with Bitcoins a lot. And if there is a duty to investigate, how far do you need to look back? Is that one transaction, two, three, four? Or at the beginning of time, is a Bitcoin still tainted if 20 transactions ago it is used for a drug transport? And cannot I use it then anymore? How far does that duty to investigate reach, if it exists? And also, does the mere fact that a coin has been on a dark market prove that it derives from a criminal offense? Because you can upload your some Bitcoins or Ether or Moneros to a dark market, and it just sits there. And on the dark market, you can buy drugs, weapons, counterfeit money, but also manuals. And manuals for lockpicking, for instance. That's not illegal. So what if I uploaded my money to a dark market just to buy manuals. Of course, I can order it via Amazon, but let's just say I did that. Does that make my coin illegal? Or what if I uploaded some bitcoins to a dark market because I was wanting to buy drugs, but later I said, nah, maybe just not do it, and I just take it off again. Then Wallet Explorer would show, hey, alert, this coin has been on the dark market, and now you're a money launderer, because you know. So I'm interested to see how the judge is going to decide about that part. And also, that's the last part. Can a prosecutor legally use Wallet Explorer to prove the origin of a Bitcoin? It's like it's Wallet Explorer is made by, I think, a Czech guy. It's an algorithm. And I'm sure the prosecutor doesn't understand the algorithm. I don't understand the algorithm, and the judges are also not understanding the algorithm. But the point is, some of you do understand this algorithm. And that's to come back to my story, is that hackers and lawyers should in some way work together, because I'm applying the law. I'm providing these questions to the judge, but I also need help of people that explain to me, to the prosecutor and to the judge, how Wallet Explorer works. Are there flaws in it? Does it work correctly? How does it work? What are the consequences of accepting it? And that's basically my the question. If there's anybody of you who is interested in this topic and you want to take a look at this algorithm Wallet Explorer use, and you're willing to provide information to the court or to our firm about how it works, you want to negotiate or talk about what we can do about it, just email us, text us, and we can have a talk about it. There's no obligation or duty to anything, but I do not have the wisdom of understanding this algorithm, and I think I'm never going to have in my life that that kind of power. But some of you do, and I'm a defense lawyer who is in this case with defending bitcoins. So if there's anybody who is willing to provide us this information and work together on it, we would be happy with that. Okay, that's the end of my presentation. I think I have some few minutes to answer questions, right?
Yes, we do have some time for questions. Please.
Oh, thanks. It's off.
The first microphone is on. The second microphone is not on.
No. Yes.
Yeah, not here.
You stated that our government is now allowed to use zero-day exploits in criminal investigations. One thing the Minister of Justice said in this discussion was that they still commit to doing this responsible disclosure, and that they would, after using zero-day exploits, take a responsible path on actually making public the exploit.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts about this?
Sorry?
What are your thoughts about this?
My thoughts is that if our government is aware of any vulnerability, they should immediately close the gap and not use it first to hack into the privacy of other citizens. I think it's best if you know it. It's because every day a vulnerability stays open is a danger to our internet safety. So I think this should be closed immediately.
I'm not sure, but from what I understand, so there's this whole long-running discussion about the fungibility of Bitcoin, the right to spend it. And from what I understand is that with cash, as if you accept cash, you are exempt from any responsibility about where that cash has been. Because if that were not the case, we would ruin our economy. If, as a merchant, if you would accept cash, and it would be your duty to check what its history was, then it would harm business.
Yeah,
couldn't you make the case, by analogy, that if you accept Bitcoin, that, I mean, there has been jurisprudence that considers Bitcoin a good, but there's also been jurisprudence that considers Bitcoin a money, that Bitcoin, by analogy, falls under that regime as well.
Yeah, sure. I think you're making a really good point there. But it's with cash, you're not unlimited allowed to take enormous amounts of cash. There's also some duty to investigate. There's some anti-money laundering laws, for example, for lawyers, jewelers, car dealers, that actually do have a duty to investigate. But that's regulated, and it starts with a certain amount of transaction, the height. I think it's 50,000 euros, I guess. But you make a fairly good point. I think there should be an analogy between bitcoins and cash, yeah.
Microphone in the back. Yeah.
Yeah. Hi. I was wondering if there was any discussion with the prosecutor about the Bitcoin, as when you receive it, well, you don't know which wallet's coming from or what coins you're going to receive. So, any thoughts?
Yeah, I have a lot of clients that that have Bitcoins, and they bought it a couple of years ago. And now it's worth pretty much, and they say, okay, I want to cash out, but I want to do it legally. I want to comply with all the rules. So they come to our office and say, okay, tell me what I should do to comply with all the rules so I can legally cash my coins. And me and my colleague investigated it a lot. And we have to tell every client that actually we do not know. And it's not because we don't know. The prosecutor's office also doesn't know. And other, like the tax agencies, they don't know. And actually what we did is we called them and we wrote them a letter. I called the Functioneel Pakket in the Netherlands. That's the prosecutor's office that is capable of making rules about it. I said, okay, please provide us rules or guidelines on how what we can do and what we cannot do. But for now, they're not willing to. So it's nobody knows. And my advice is always just do as much as you can do to keep a paper trail. If you don't buy coins with cash, buy them online via brokers, and make screenshots of all the transactions you do, and keep an administration so you can always prove where your coin comes from and what you did with it. But to be honest, for now, it's interesting. It's a gray zone. We're not know where it's heading.
Microphone in the back. The microphone in the back.
Yeah. Thanks. I listened to your presentation, and I'm, well, now more worried than I was before. Thanks.
Yeah, I'm sorry. But
well, it's more law-wise. If you say that laws can be, well, embedded and well applied as some entity fit, what safeguards are there to prevent us to, well, becoming, and then excuse my language, banana republic or something alike, if every judge or every entity can interpret it in the way they see fit?
That is actually a good question. Of course, the judges don't have unlimited power in bending. And in the 80s, we had a really strict way of interpreting law so that judges don't have room to interpret some kind of writing, like a code of conduct. But the last years, we see, to my opinion, unfortunately, that this the room for interpretation is being broadened. For example, the examples I gave you are like are the most extreme versions of what judges did to apply old laws to new facts. But that's also what with money laundering. At the time the criminal code for money laundering was written, Bitcoin didn't exist, any cryptocurrency didn't exist. So now they're applying old laws that are not, they didn't think by then when they were writing it, they didn't think about, okay, what happens with cryptocurrencies? No, they didn't, because there were no cryptocurrencies. But now we're applying this old law to new techniques. And yeah, that raises questions, and I'm wondering how it will end up that way. But I wouldn't say that we're a banana republic, as you say it. But I think we had better times in case of fundamental rights. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
In addition to the Bitcoin world, do you have any experience with those zero knowledge coins like Zcash, Zcash, and Monero? Because then it's very difficult if you have these anonymous transactions.
For example, Monero with the three keys. To be frank, nobody knows what's going to happen with that, and I wouldn't be surprised if, for example, Monero would in some day be forbidden in the Netherlands, because there is no way authorities or intelligence agencies can look into that for now. I've talked to somebody about it, and they say, okay, Bitcoin, that's fairly easy, we're going to watch it, Ether as well, but Monero is just black hole for us. And It depends on where society goes, but there is a chance that our government will decide, okay, well, that's too risky, that's too perfect for criminals, that's too perfect for money laundering, maybe just prohibit it. But I don't know, it's politics, it's democracy, we can vote about it, so we'll see what happens. Okay.
Thanks.
Microphone in the front.
Well, the state's bought different programs to break in the computers of everyone. Of everyone, of every user.
Yeah.
What if a broken computer is used by a bad boy? And what is if bad boys get these programs? I'm sure they won't be in secret very long.
Sorry, I didn't understand the last sentence. No.
I'm sure these programs will not get in bad hands.
Nobody knows. I'm not sure how or police is going to hack our systems, but if they develop a program for it. Yeah, they should make sure that it doesn't fall into bad hands, as you say. But of course, there's no guarantee to it at all. But of course, there need to be safeguards for it. But no, of course, you cannot guarantee. But to be honest, I'm not sure on how they're going to do it, or if they're going to develop their own programs for hacking. I'm not sure. But yeah, if they make a program, it can fall in the wrong hands. And also, before the next question, what I want to say about money laundering of bitcoins. It's a bit scary, and yeah, I'm worried. But as a normal hobbyist Bitcoin user, you shouldn't be too afraid for prosecution, because the prosecution is primarily focused on the notorious cash traders that trade cash for 10,000 euros at least, and do it by encryption phones in back alleys in the dark on the street. Those are the guys they're trying to get. If you have a Bitcoin wallet or an Ether wallet and some coins derived from a criminal offense, I don't think you should be too worried though. It could be technically illegal, depends on what's going to happen. But if some coins of yours are tainted, I shouldn't worry too much, as long as you're not going on the streets buying with cash and hanging out with shady people with it.
Okay, microphone in the back.
Okay, actually you just replied to my question, which was whether you think there is a motive for these prosecutions other than money laundering.
No, not yet, no. Their capacity is limited, and they're focusing on some people that actually everybody knows that they're buying bitcoins that derive from drugs, and because they're following, there's observations. But there's a legal problem behind it that could affect everybody, but the prosecutors just mainly focused on drug traffickers.
And also, regarding laws that are about to be introduced or that have already been introduced, for example, about zero-day vulnerabilities,
yeah.
Are you aware whether this is the result of alignment with the EU directives, or is this a primary lawmaking process here in the Netherlands?
It's in primary lawmaking process in the Netherlands. I'm not aware of any European rules about it, no.
Thank you.
Well, I wanted to hear from you the legal consequences if my computer is hacked through one of these programs of the state.
That's an interesting question. Now,
it might be if it's a big business, well, that could be very costly.
So basically, if I get you right, you're asking what if my computer gets hacked by criminals using the program of our government. That's an interesting question about liability. That's not criminal law, though. It's civil law. You need to sue the government because you have damages. I'm not sure. It moved away from the field of criminal law to private law, which I'm not an expert in. But it's a good. Maybe you could ask Bit for Freedom. Maybe you have a good answer to that question. But it's an interesting case, though.
Hey there. I think you already have some cybercrime court dates, and I would like to ask if did the judges understand when you explained some technical stuff what they're judging at, if they're like understand it and then thought up well what they would fuck up if I judged the false way. Did they like really think about it when you explained the technical stuff behind it, what it would be if they really have the false decision for all the people outside?
Well, judges can only make a decision if they feel informed enough, and often they hire people to give that information to them. And in the Netherlands, we have for cybercrime, there is in The Hague, there's a cybercrime office of all judges that they can call or email, and they get information about it. It's also, I think, the duty of the prosecutor to, if he builds a case, to make sure that the consequences of a conviction of the case he brought to the court are known. But also for the defense attorneys, there's a lot of work to do to provide this information, because of course I believe the judges in the Netherlands are well informed and are trying to be as informed as possible, but you do not know what you do not know, right? So if there's somebody discovers anything like, okay, hey, this might be a really bad implication to that decision, speak up, call a lawyer, go to the newspaper, try something, because I think, especially in this new area, especially in law, cybercrime is relatively new, and there's in the upcoming years, there's a lot of decisions to make, and we all should make sure that the decisions that are being made are as well informed as possible.
Thank you.
Okay, microphone in front. We have time for one or two questions.
Okay.
It's a matter of time before it becomes known that our police has used up till that moment unknown vulnerability to hack into systems of people that are being trialed in a criminal court. So you asked earlier in your presentation if we could help you make a case against this cryptocurrency problem. I have something I can ask you to do for us.
Tell me.
As early in time as possible, let us know when you find in a criminal case evidence that our police has used open vulnerabilities to hack potential criminals.
Sure.
As much data as possible in a technical way about these 0 days, so that we can make sure that those 0 days then get patched in the real world, and so that we can start civil cases against the government for not having made public the information about these zero-day exploits that could have potentially have done harm to our computers, so that we can actually try and get money from the government for not having made public that, which is their public duty to actually make our world safer.
Okay, I'm gonna I'm gonna promise you this. As soon as I'm aware of our government using this vulnerability, and I'm allowed to make that information public, I will do so. I will do so. That's a promise. I wouldn't even just put it on our website. I would go to any newspaper that will hear it to explain that. Yeah, you have my word on that.
We have time for one more question.
Okay, so 1 or 2 years ago, a German judge from one of the highest courts wrote an article about the German paragraph on money laundering. And his hypothesis was that this paragraph, being expanded and expanded every year, basically is violating the law meanwhile, because the it basically leaves only a very little chance of not committing that crime. Because so he made a calculation based on the annual usage of drugs in Germany and the usual price of that, and the fact that something is considered money laundering if it was paid by at least 1% of money that results from a crime. So you can have 100 times the tainted amount of money, and comparing the vast amount of money that is tainted by this fact, there's basically most of the money that flows around in Germany is tainted, and therefore you, even if you don't know whether your specific money comes from that, the vast amount of money ensures that by statistics, at least it's quite probable that you have some money that resulted from a crime on your bank account, and therefore you basically have no chance of not committing that crime. So
you're making a good case, because what's criminal law if everything you do is criminal anyway? You need to make you need to split up between actual money laundering. Okay, what is now actually what did somebody did wrong? What's the wrongdoing in it? Except for just possessing cash that is tainted, or bitcoins that are tainted. Yeah.
So maybe you can adapt that to bitcoins.
Sure, that's going to be, and also
more widespread.
If you can statistically prove that, like those kind of researches are the researches I like, because then you can just show how idiot it can be sometimes. Yeah, you make a good point of that.
Thank you very much. Let's thank Arnoud again for his talk.